Vaydaber Adonai El Moshe V'El Aharon Lemor Zoschukas HaTorah Asher Tziva Adonai Lemor Daber El Bnei Yisrael V'yikhu Elecha Fara Aduma Temima Asher Ein Bahmum Asher lo ola oleha ol. And God spoke to Moshe and to Aaron, saying, "This is the chok of the Torah, the quintessential chok. We'll talk a lot about that in a moment. That God has commanded, saying, speak to the people of Israel that they shall take for you, Moshe, a red cow, completely red, that has no blemish, and that has never had a yoke or burden placed upon it."
OU Israel presents
in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. Hopefully this one will be longer than last week's. Recording and first availability. Take two. Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Chukat. Then we say, recording and first availability, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the fifth day, of the month of Tammuz, 5777, corresponding to June 29th. And that's about it. Parshat Chukat stands on its own. Last week, I really did not speak about it being Rosh Chodesh, but we're now into the month of Tammuz, and maybe I'll comment on that in a while. In the meantime, Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Shir hama'alot mima'amakim k'raticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihyena oznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor yah Adonai miya amod ki imecha haslicha l'ma'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kivita nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim l'boker shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbei imo fedut, v'hu yifdeh et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara v'ashivya ha-omedim ebein bayam uvein bayabasha ha-makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha u'meyafela la'ora u'mishibud l'gu'ula hashta ba'agala u'vizman kariv v'nomar Amen. Okay, the first part of Parshat Chukat consists of 22 verses, chapter 19 in Bamidbar, and that entire chapter, all 22 psukim, are borrowed for the second Torah reading, the Maftir, of Parshat Para, and this is the original source. The topic for this first section is Para Aduma, the red cow. I think red heifer is not a good term, but the red cow. And that consists mainly of two parts, almost half and half in the chapter. The first part consists of the instructions for preparing a potion from the ashes of a red cow. And the second part consists of details related to one form of tum'ah, ritual defilement, ritual impurity, specifically that from contact with a dead body. There are many, many other sources of tum'ah. The very first Mishnayot of Seder Taharot presents layers, the lowest form of tum'ah, and a bunch of items, and the next higher than that, and higher than that, and higher than that, and finally you come to, and higher than them all is tum'at meit, the tum'ah, ritual defilement. I'm going to keep using the word tum'ah. Occasionally I'll say that it means ritual defilement, but it would work well if you remember that now. The highest level of tum'ah, the most severe, is tumat meit, from contact with the body. And the Mishnah explains that it is the only form of tumah that can be contracted, transmitted, being under the same roof as a dead body, where all other sources of tumah require some physical contact of one type or another. But tumat meit, even ba'ohel, under the same roof. So what you have is the concept of ritual impurity, to which we have been introduced earlier in the Torah, but here is its formal presentation of a person dying. And right before that, the cure, not a good word, the treatment, better word, the method by which one who becomes Temei Meit can become Tahor. So first let's talk about the Parah Adumah itself. I mentioned at the beginning when I was reading the opening verses that the Torah introduces the Parah Adumah as the quintessential chok. A chok is generally considered a mitzvah in the Torah that does not have a readily understandable reason for it. It defies logic, it defies common sense. It's not the kind of thing that a society would develop on its own. It is there in the Torah for the Jewish people because it is a divine command. That is the nature of a chok. Just to use a more common example, sha'atnez. The Torah prohibits us from wearing garments that contain wool and linen together. Now that should strike a person as odd. We can wear any fabric that we want, a whole 100% wool, a blend of wool and cotton. We can have cotton and linen. We can have polyester. We can have silk. We can have all kind of fibers in our clothing, except for wool and linen together. Let's take it one step further. I can weave wool and linen together to make a tapestry, drapes. I just can't wear them or wrap myself in them wearing style. Now that, when you look at it, I was going to say when you first look at it, but even when you second and third and fourth look at it, strikes you as very odd. What's with the combination of wool and linen specifically that any other combination of fabrics or any fabric by itself, including wool by itself and linen by itself, I could wear? And wool and linen I could even use for non-wearing purposes. What's with this prohibition of wearing garments of wool and linen together, known as sha'atnez? The first answer is, it is a chok. It is a mitzvah in the Torah, a prohibition in the Torah, that does not have a reason attached to it. Most don't. But we also cannot readily figure out what's going on here. The conditions and details are confusing to us if we try to explain it. And basically we say, it's a chok. And there are many chukim in the Torah. The opposite of a chok is called a mishpat. A mishpat is a law of the Torah also, one that is easily understood, one that societies around the world and throughout history would develop if they were just societies, and you almost don't need to be given a reason because we are capable of figuring it out for ourselves. So the laws of damages, for example, if your dog goes into your neighbor's garden and damages his rose bush, and while he's damaging his rose bush, he gets scratched up by the thorns and has to be taken to the vet. So basically your neighbor, his property, have caused damages to your property, and your property, your dog, has caused damage to his. This is to be adjudicated by a court of three judges. And the concept of a person paying for damages that he is responsible for causing is not at all obscure or enigmatic. It's readily understandable. And therefore, that mitzvah belongs to the category of mishpat. There are plenty in between of some melt or merger or fusion combination of chukim and mishpatim. But I hope you get the point here. Now back to this specific chok. This is not shatnez we're talking about. This is the one that gets a drum roll by the Torah saying, Zot chukat ha-Torah. It gets a further drum roll by a statement of King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, the wisest of all men, that he has achieved understanding of just about everything, with the exception of the unusual nature of the Para Aduma, the red cow. Usually one specific issue with Para Aduma is pointed to as the most enigmatic, but the whole thing really shouts the concept of chok. Let's go forward a step. Remember I said that after the discussion in the Torah, the presentation of the red cow, you have what do you use it for? And this, I think, is a classic example of giving us the remedy before the malady. The malady is tumat mat, ritual defilement from contact with a dead body. Let's talk about that for a moment first. A body, during its lifetime, the physical body is partnered with a soul. That combination makes up the human being, and because we are human beings with free will and consciences, we are able to make decisions of how we should behave. And the goal of a Torah way of life is to do mitzvot, good things, and to avoid prohibitions. When the soul is called back to its maker, and a person dies at 120 years or any other number, the body is an empty shell and will return to the earth from which it came. The body is considered a source of defilement, I would say, for two major reasons. Number one, it represents that part of the person who, because of sin, did not properly treat its spiritual partner, the soul, properly. And therefore, as a reminder to us, the rest of the living people, contact with a dead body makes us tamei and requires us to undergo a purification process. Rabbi Sacks, in his latest article in Torah Tidbits, and wherever else his articles appear, mentioned the tremendous difference between life and death, and paraduma, tuma, is one of those things that brings across that message. And interestingly, he also pointed out that the prohibitions of milk and meat also make that point, and it's a point that I've been saying for a long time. That is that meat represents the cow or the animal when it's dead, as in the expression dead meat. You cannot take meat from a living animal. Not only Jews can't, but nobody can. And milk is exactly the opposite. Milk is a life-giving liquid, a nourishing liquid for mammals, that which keeps them alive and sustains them, that which is taken from the cow when it is alive, or the sheep or the goat, and therefore represents life, where meat represents death. And we need this sharp daily reminder when we look at our meat dishes and milk dishes and meat silverware and milk silverware, etc., etc., being very aware of the requirements both of the Torah and Chazal, the rabbis, of how to properly separate milk from meat. Back to Paraduma. So, the second half of chapter 19 deals with different ways that a person's body transmits ritual impurity and tells us how to remove that impurity, that defilement. First, let me say, I can't say first, I've already said a bunch of things first. Next, let me say that it is not a sin to become tummy. Sin comes in when a person who is tummy does something that he's not allowed to do in a state of ritual impurity. That would mean two major things. One is going into the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, when one is tamei, and this includes, according to most opinions, the place where the Beit HaMikdash stood or might have stood on the Temple Mount, even today. So that's one very big no-no. A person who is tamei mate or any other kind of tuma cannot go into the Beit HaMikdash area. Second thing, a person who is tamei may not eat sacred foods. That we don't have today because we're all considered tamei. But we're talking about a time when we had the ability to rid ourselves of this defilement. And then there were sacred foods of sacrifices, of truma for a kohen, challah for a kohen, and not allowed to eat any sacred food, Korban Pesach, in a state of impurity. There's an asterisk on that, which we won't get into now. But those are the two big no-nos. But being tamei per se is not a sin. When one is tamei and has an opportunity or situation where he needs to become tahor, or he chooses to become tahor, then he has to undergo a procedure, part of which makes sense, and part of it is hard to accept on its face because it seems fraught with enigmatic rules. So what we're talking about is counting 7 days. On the seventh day, towards the end of the day, the person goes to a mikveh, a ritual bath, immerses himself, and when the stars come out after the seventh day, he becomes tahor, ritually not defiled, ritually pure, provided that he has undergone the other procedure that is required only in the case of tumat mat. In other words, mikveh and time generally can render a person who is tamei tahor, with the exception of ritual defilement to a dead body, which requires one additional thing, and that is the sprinkling on him by a kohen of the potion made from the ashes of a para aduma and live spring water and a few other ingredients. And here's where we get a little wild in the presentation. A red cow, which needs to be inspected carefully, head to toe, to tail, that there are no black or white or any other color hairs except the reddish hairs. Two, non-red hairs under certain circumstances invalidate this animal from being a para aduma. A para aduma has to be at least 2 years old into its third year, and therefore when it's born, newborn calf, and it looks reddish, then the owner will take measures to see if he has a potential para aduma to sell to the Beit HaMikdash. And that will require him to take care of the animal, protect it from harm, feed it, raise it for at least 2 years, never benefiting from it, and never working it. And working it is more intricate than it seems. The classic working of a cow is harnessing it to a plow and having her pull a plow through the soil. But pulling a wagon qualifies. Giving pony rides or calf rides to little children at a birthday party is also included. And that would invalidate the animal from ever being a para aduma in the process that continues. So let's say you now have a red cow in its third year of life, and you inform the Beit HaMikdash, Kohanim in charge of Para Aduma, that you've got that. They send an inspector or two down to your herd, and you show them the Para Aduma, and they give it a thorough inspection. They're looking for non-red hairs, and they're looking for blemishes that would render it unfit. I don't know exactly how they can investigate whether it ever had a yoke, like if you put a child on its back to give it a ride. I don't think that shows up in the animal. So I don't know the practical side of how they would determine and verify the owner's claim that it never was burdened in any way. There's even a Mishnah that describes throwing a blanket on him, on her, and the question is, what purpose did you do that for? If you say to keep flies away from the animal, then that's okay. That's not a burden that a human is imposing on the animal. But if it's to carry the blanket because your hands are full of other things and you're walking a certain distance, that would render it unfit. I don't know how that is actually checked, but that's how it has to be. then a Kohen, and I can't even go into all of the details that I know, let alone the ones that I don't know, but a Kohen who has been sequestered for 7 days from his family in the precinct of the Beit HaMikdash and been purified repeatedly by different potions from previous Parah Aduma, the stocks of which stay around for a long time. And he will then take the animal to Har HaZeitim, the Mount of Olives, opposite the valley from Har HaBayit in that direction of Har HaZeitim, where the Parah Aduma is slaughtered. Some of its blood is sprinkled towards the Beit HaMikdash, but certainly doesn't reach there. And then the animal is completely burned. Its ashes are collected by another Kohen. All the Kohanim who are working on this animal now in preparation of the potion must begin by being Tahor, as Tahor as can be. And other ingredients, a hyssop shrub and a piece of cedar wood, are put into the fire, and they're put into the potion and live spring water. And the remarkable thing that I referred to before, the one that is reputedly that element which Shlomo HaMelech couldn't figure out, is the fact that this potion will purify people who are tummy, but along the way during its preparation, they render people that had to be tahor, renders them tummy. It is mitaher tumeim and mitame tahorim. And that's considered an enigma. By the way, I believe that we understand, at least by analogy, that there are some medications which are meant to be helpful to people with certain maladies, that if those medications which will heal the sick are taken by someone who is not sick, it might make him sick. So at least that gives you a handle as an analogy in understanding it. The whole idea is that this potion is now diluted with other spring water, and natural live spring water with certain conditions, and the person requires a spritz on the third day and on the seventh day of his seven-day counting period of being ritually defiled, and then mikvah on the last day. The day passes, the stars come out at the beginning of the eighth day, and the person is tahor. It is shrouded in, this is the rule, this is what you got to do. Nonetheless, many commentaries throughout the centuries have attempted to understand the issue of Parah Aduma, and many of them relate it to the golden calf. The golden calf, and if you're familiar with the fact that gold can be yellow and gold could be white and gold could be pink, the pink gold will fit very well with the concept that the red cow is the proverbial mother of the golden calf and is called upon to clean up the mess made by the golden calf. There's a lot of rabbinic literature on the connection, the fact that the golden calf was a rejection of the yoke of heaven upon us, and the fact that we need a red cow that never had a yoke put on it is tied in with that somehow. And various other elements of the whole process relate back to the golden calf. The golden calf was a sin. Being tamei, which I said before, is not a sin. But because of sin, as I did mention before, there is such a thing as a status of a dead body being a source of tuma. In other words, hypothetically, if the human being had gone through its entire life always treating the soul as what it is, chelek elokut, part of the divine essence, whatever that means, and never having sinned, then the body would not be tummy, and we wouldn't be talking about this whole thing. But because there's no such thing as a human being that doesn't sin, the body has been declared a source of tumah as a reminder of that very, very first communal sin of the people of Israel 40 days after the awesome, awe-inspiring experience at Sinai, revelation at Sinai in the receiving of the Torah, where, in essence, the people of Israel were starting with a blank screen, a blank slate, and there they went, Egel HaZahav, major sin. So we can say that that moment reflects the decision by God, made earlier than that moment, that a dead body shall be a source of ritual impurity, defilement, because there ain't no such thing as a totally sin-free human being. So there's your connection between the Egel HaZahav being the proverbial kapara, atonement, for the sin of the golden calf, when we're not talking about a korban chatat, a sin offering in the Beit HaMikdash. This was not that. But we are making this link between sin and sin explaining why there is such a thing as tumat meit from contact with a dead body. I hope you follow that. If you didn't, let me know and I'll try again. Before I continue on a whole different aspect of the beginning of the parsha, you'll see. I want to play a song. It's from the first album of Regesh, back in the old days, when Regesh meant calm, and it's a calm song. The words are the first words spoken by a Jew every single morning. Upon awakening, he acknowledges to God, Modeh ani lefanecha, Melech Chai V'Kayam, a living and eternal king. I thank you, Shehechezarta b'nishmati b'chemla, that you restored to me, returned to me, my soul with mercy. Rabba emunatecha, expansive and great are your beliefs, or our beliefs in you, or your trustworthiness, better. We have a notion that death is a fraction, sleep is a fraction of death. We have this, image of the soul leaving the body in some way. Obviously, if the body continues to breathe and the heart continues to beat, we're not talking about death, but we are talking about a relaxed state of the body where traditionally we see the soul returning in some way to God to give a daily accounting of the life of the person. And each morning when we arise, we thank him for restoring that soul, especially because we have midrashic sources that indicate that the soul does not really want to go back into a body. The soul is a purer spiritual state than the body, or the body-soul combination, and doesn't want to go back anymore, has a nightly taste of what it's like to be part of the heavenly realm. And God says, nope, sorry, you're going back into that body, and have a good day. So we thank God first thing in the morning. And the fact that the rabbinic literature has required us to wash ritually in the morning is to remove that quasi-tuma state. Ritual impurity is associated with death, and sleep is a fraction of death, and therefore there is a fraction of tuma which remains in the body when the soul is restored in the morning. Hence our requirement to wash netilat yadayim ritually with a cup at least 3, if not 4 times on each hand alternatingly, and then we're able to say regular brachot, mention God's name, continue with prayer, continue with Torah learning after Birchat HaTorah. But the very first thing, the second thing, is washing the hands. The very first thing, even before we watch ritually, is to say those 12 words of Modeh Ani Lefanecha. And we don't use God's name here. We refer to him as Melech Chai V'Kayam. And thank him, Shehechezarta B'Nishmati B'Chemla, with mercy, Rabba Emunatecha. So here is Regesh, Volume 1, Track 1, Modeh Ani. Okay, let's backtrack to the opening significant words of the Sedra, the phrase that gave the Sedra its name, Zot Chukat HaTorah. Rashi, on Zot Chukat HaTorah, why is the Torah calling Paraduma a chok? What does it say to us and what does it do for us? According to Rashi, it gives us our answer to the Satan, and the nations of the world, and I will add, sadly, fellow Jews as well, who scoff at our mitzvot, especially the chukim, something like Parah Aduma, and they make fun of, why do you do things you don't even understand? Why do you do such weird things? And we say, with pride, this is a command of God. And I fulfill God's commands of me without challenging them and without needing reasons and logic before I will do it. I've always said that it's sort of like the Na'aseh V'Nishma, the proclamation that the Jewish people made at Har Sinai, that we will do and then we will understand, but the commitment is to do first. Very much not like the people of the state of Missouri, which is known as the Show Me State. If you can show me the sense in keeping Shabbat the way Halacha requires, I'll give it a thought. Somebody said that to me once. Not a best way to start learning about Hilchot Shabbat, but I understand where the person was coming from. And when you say, you know, back-breaking labor in the field is not allowed on Shabbat, I'd say the average person accepts that and understands that. But telling someone that flipping a light switch or shutting off a light switch or turning on a radio or a television, or texting on a cell phone, that is milacha, that is labor. It's not labor in the common sense of physical labor, but it's certainly a creative activity that fits under the guidelines of Torah or rabbinic violation. Anyway, we're not getting into that. But the scoffers of the world, we say to them, I do this because it is God's command, and I don't challenge it or question it. And you can scoff all you want. This is the nature of our commitment to Torah and to God and to Torah. Okay, having said that, I need to move a little bit in another direction in two different ways. There is a principle which we really don't make up on our own, so I'm not saying this with any kind of authority behind it. I'm saying it as an idea. The idea is based on one of the 13 Talmudic principles by which we link the oral law with the written word. And the basis on which we learn many halachot. And this particular rule says the following. Davar sheyatza min haklal, an item which has been taken out of, singled out for attention, out of the general rule. Davar sheyatza min haklal, lo lelamed al atzmo yatza. It doesn't come out to teach us something about it itself. Ella lelamed al haklal kulo yatza, but it's to teach us something about the whole rule. Remember, I can't say with any kind of authority that this comes, that this is matching what I'm about to say. But the idea is certainly there. And that is when you have a single mitzvah that is identified as Zot Chukat HaTorah, part of that is saying, you know what? This idea applies to all mitzvot, not just the Parah Aduma, not just Shatnez that I wanted to put into that category before, not just Tefillin, but every single mitzvah, including the Mishpatim, including the common sense, logical, reasonable mitzvot, there is always an element of chok where the logic breaks down. But more than that, there is an element of what Rashi says, we say to the scoffers of the world, we do this because God commanded it. And that goes even for the reasonable things. Why did you give that hungry person who can't afford a meal, why did you give him money for a meal or food? Because he needed it, because I'm a human being and I feel sorry for him and I wanted to help him. Yes, but there's one part of the answer that should go first. I helped him because God commanded me to help him. And then, when what God commands me is compatible with my own feelings, that's a bonus. And what happens if there's a mitzvah that you don't feel like doing? If your reasons for doing mitzvot are because they feel good, then I don't know how motivated you would be to do a mitzvah that doesn't feel good. But if your motivation is, this is what God wants of me, this is what God demands of me, and my love for God and Torah and Judaism is such that I don't want to disappoint him, therefore I do it. And if it happens to be a nice thing to do and it helps somebody out, that's terrific. But essentially, every mitzvah has that element of chok, where anyone who scoffs on our observance of Torah and mitzvot, we answer, this is the rule. Now, let me give you a very tiny example of one application of this idea. I would say, if someone without the background were to ask about, what are you saying before you eat, before you take a sip of water, what did you say? I said a blessing. What blessing did you say? So I told the person, Shahakol Niyah Bidvaro, and I explain it. I think a person, reasonable person, would say, that's a very, very nice thing to do. It's not weird. I understand it. And if I want to do it, I could do it also. But if you give some of the details, when you make a bracha on a glass of water, hold the glass of water in your right hand, not your left. Now you're entering into the potential scoffer's question. And I've heard it in a gross way. Oh, you think God cares if I hold it in my right hand or my left hand? Come on, give me a break. Not the point. There is a rhyme and a reason, and even if you don't know it, and even if you can't figure it out, there is a reason. This is not a Torah law, that this is a rabbinic requirement, or let's say preference, when you make a bracha, that you hold the object upon which you are saying the blessing in your right hand rather than your left. It has to do with the representation of the right representing God's side of mercy, and the left represents strict judgment. These are Kabbalistic kind of ideas, which I really don't even have to mention now, because I'm talking about the chok side, where you say to someone, okay, that's the way it says it in Shulchan Aruch. Now, again, this is not a Torah law, this is a rabbinic law. But the rabbis built in to many things that we do, details, and not every single detail lends itself immediately to understand and appreciate why we have to do it. But the fact is, we're supposed to do what we're told to do. But we're supposed to strive to understand it. Now, I'm torn here, because Zot Chukat HaTorah means we're proud to do things because this is what we're commanded to do. And I don't ask, and I don't challenge, but I do. I ask not as satisfy me with an answer and I'll consider following the rule. Don't satisfy me, I'm not going to do it. That's the wrong approach. But if I say, and I mean in my heart, that I will do what halacha requires me to do all the way down the line, I then am entitled and maybe even encouraged to ask, to read, to learn, to study, to ponder. Why? I remember a long time ago, we're talking 40-ish years ago, maybe a little bit more, teaching at Yeshiva of Central Queens and mentioning that it says in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch that when you put on your shoes in the morning, you put your right shoe on first, then your left, you tie the left, and then tie the right. And when you take them off, you do it the opposite way. One kid in class blurted out, "That's the dumbest thing I ever heard." Meaning, what is Shulchan Aruch, code of Jewish law, telling me how to put on my shoes? Well, there happens to be a whole answer to this, because Judaism is not just a religion, it's a way of life. And a way of life covers you from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep in just about everything that you do in the course of the day. Even going to the bathroom. I always find that that has a shock value to people who are not familiar with Judaism, that we have a blessing, not only which other religions recognize, a blessing before we eat food, thanking God for the bounty which we are about to take part of, but we have a blessing after successfully going to the bathroom. It's called Asher Yotzar, and I'm not going to talk about that now. But again, the idea, I said before I was a little conflicted here. I want to leave it in the realm of Zot Chukat HaTorah, even though we're talking in many examples that I've given about rabbinic law, sort of part of a package deal, that first level of every mitzvah, every halacha, is Zot Chukat HaTorah. This is the law. My commitment is I'll do it. But we are encouraged, as I said before, to try to understand and appreciate. Because when you do things with more enthusiasm, you do things with more confidence. The business of the tying of the shoe, very interesting that the one activity involved in putting shoes on, which is tying the laces, is connected to the mitzvah of tefillin, where we tie our tefillin on our left arm. A left-handed person would do it on the right, and he would do that switch with the shoes also. What's the connection between the tying of the shoes and the wearing of tefillin? This is based on Avraham Avinu, Father Abraham, who made a pledge to the king of Sodom after he saved the people of Sodom, including his nephew Lot, from during the battle of the five kings versus the four kings. And he was offered the spoils of war, and he said, aside from what I need for the allies that helped me, I will not touch anything from a thread to a shoelace, meaning nothing. The thread represents the mitzvah of talit and tzitzit. The shoelace, leather strap of a sandal, represents the wearing of tefillin. And what it does is take something from the realm of religious behavior, like the daily wearing of tefillin, and immerses it, not the right word I'm looking for, but spreads it to everyday mundane activity. Now, there is no Torah law that I have to put my right shoe on first and then my left. But when it is presented in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, it becomes a reminder from the mundane to the sublime, and that's beneficial to the person himself and to those to whom he teaches and explains what he's doing. Now let me add one other tidbit, and that is that I feel comfortable presenting the chok idea beyond the red cow issue, because if you do a search in the Torah for the phrase Zot Chukat HaTorah, it occurs with another mitzvah, not just Parah Adumah. It occurs in Parshat Matot with the mitzvah of the instructions which became Jewish law of Elazar HaKohen to the soldiers who returned from the battle against Midian with vessels that they had plundered, which included vessels made of gold and silver and copper and iron and tin and lead, in other words, metals, and instructed them on how to purify them and make them kosher and acceptable. And it had to do with burning out and with water, and developed into our laws of koshering of kalim and also toveling kalim. And that is much more graspable, if that's a word, than the loftier concepts of para aduma. So I could say to myself, wait a minute, it makes a lot of sense that if there's a gold vessel that was used for non-kosher purposes, I can kosher it, make it kosher, by burning it out. And I could make it with the tahara of Beit Yisrael by immersing it in a mikveh. And I understand that. But the Torah calls it Zot Chukat HaTorah. And next week, no, 2 weeks from now, we will take a look at two mitzvot that the Torah calls Chukat Mishpat, which really confuse the issue, because I've been presenting Chok and Mishpat as opposites, and here are individual mitzvot that are referred to as a combination of the two. But that's another topic. So let me wish you... Oh, let me quickly tell you what else you have in Chukat, because it's not just Pora Aduma. You have the death of Miriam Hanaviyah. We're talking about the last year of the wandering in the wilderness. The death of Miriam Hanaviyah, and then that of Aharon as well. And the being told to speak to a rock to give water, and instead Moshe hit the rock, and that's a topic all by itself, which we're not going to get into. After Aharon's death, the Kena'ani from the Arad area in the Negev attacked Israel because we lost the protective heavenly clouds that accompanied us in the merit of Aharon HaKohen, who had passed on. And then our successful attack back, the Song of the Well. It's a relatively small sedra, 87 psukim. But most noteworthy at the very end, Vayis'u b'nei Yisrael, b'nei Yisrael traveled, Vayachanu ba'arvot Moav me'ever liarden yirecho. And we camped in the area called Arvot Moav, the plains of Moav, on the other side of the Jordan River opposite Jericho. What's noteworthy about this is that we've got Balak, Pinchas, Matot, Masei, four sedras left in the book of Bamidbar. And then we have all of the book of Devarim to show off, because I do it by heart. Devarim, Voet Hanan, Ekev Re'e, Shofetim, Kiteitse, Kitisa, Nitzavim, Vayelech, Ha'azinu, and Vizot HaBracha, 11 sedras, plus the four is 15 sedras for the rest of the Torah, and we have already, at the end of Chukat, arrived at our final destination before entry into the land of Israel. That's something to think about also. Let me finish off with another track from that first volume of Regesh. Just to set the mood, the song is V'Lir Shalayim Ircha Barachamim Tashuv, and enjoy it and feel it. Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.